Hello everyone, welcome back to the IJK podcast. Today I'm thrilled to have Lucas Ruger with us. Lucas is the director of Steiger Middle East, part of a global mission dedicated to reaching young people within today's global culture. With a strong background in philosophy and theology, as well as an MA in Christian apologetics from Biola University, Lucas brings a thoughtful perspective to complex questions surrounding faith. He also runs a YouTube channel called Deflate, where he addresses common intellectual objections to theism in general and Christianity in particular. On YouTube, Lucas has engaged with renowned thinkers, including prominent philosophers like William Lane Craig, as well as famous skeptics like Alex O'Connor. Today, Lucas and I will tackle a question that has intrigued the minds of philosophers, scientists, and simply truth seekers for centuries. The question is it rational to believe in the existence of a creator? I'm looking forward to hearing Lucas's insights and perspectives on this thought-provoking topic. Lucas, welcome to the IJK podcast.
Thank you so much, Imad. It's good to be with you and good to talk to you.
Thanks for joining today. Lucas, before we start, I would like to set the stage and hear from you why this question matters in the first place. So to start off, why do you think the question of a creator's existence remains relevant today?
Yeah, very good question. I think every worldview that is out there, I mean, a worldview can be thought of as a story of reality. And no matter whether you hold a religious worldview or a worldview that doesn't incorporate any spiritual or divine being, you're going to have, again, a story about reality. And that story is going to have a beginning. And the beginning is crucial for, you know, how the story unfolds. So if you believe in a creator, that means at the beginning of the physical universe or at the beginning of reality, there is this being, whatever it may be. And if you don't, well, then, you know, your story of reality starts with the universe or reality itself. And there is a tremendous difference in telling the story of reality with either that or this beginning at the story. So I think that, I mean, the question is tremendously important. It's not important because of, well, you know, you're gonna, if you believe in a creator, you believe in a God who commands you to do this or that. Although, I mean, further down the road, when you unpack what it means to believe in a creator, these are issues that are going to come up. But ultimately, the question is, well, how does your story of reality start? And the way it starts is going to have tremendous implications for what you perceive reality to be. And thus, I think it's highly significant to ask the question, well, is there a creator or is there no creator? Because again, it will ripple down through your entire, again, narrative of reality. And that's why, again, the question is, I think, is very important.
Okay, I see. Now, you know, you and I know that there are lots of different traditions. So if we talk about the classical ones, so theism is one, deism is another one. So before we go deep into the question, let us try to attempt to define the word creator. How does it differ? How does the concept of creator differs in theism versus deism, for example, or other traditions? Like, what are the most common ones in your view?
Yeah, I mean, if we want to pick up deism as opposed to theism, for example, I mean, deism will acknowledge that there is a divine creator. However, what deism implies is that creating deity, after the act of creation, pulls back or withdraws from engaging with reality and basically lets the universe and humanity take its course. Whereas classical theism will uphold that after the divine creator gets the universe going, he or it has some sort of engagement with reality. Now, obviously, within theism, there is all sorts of different notions of what that divine being might look like. I mean, Christianity, for example, describes a God who is personal in nature, Whereas, I mean, Islam or other theistic, views will not uphold that the God, the God figure is personal. It may, again, it may still be involved in the story of reality, but not have the trait of personality. And so these are just a couple of examples of how we can kind of flesh out the differences.
All right. Okay. I guess we can now start exploring a little bit the philosophical aspect of this question. So let's start with like main arguments, main philosophical arguments that are that can support the existence of a creator. I can think of, the cosmological argument, but I'll let you maybe elaborate on that.
Yeah, I mean, sure, there are a variety of cosmological arguments. One of them is the one that most people might be familiar with these days, is the Kalam cosmological argument, which basically goes the following way. Everything, like premise one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Premise two, the universe began to exist. Conclusion, therefore, the universe has a cause. Now, again, that is these days probably the most popular and well-known cosmological argument. But there are other cosmological arguments out there. I mean, the argument for a prime mover. I mean, the cosmological arguments go very much back to Thomas Aquinas, who described those five ways of, arriving at God.
Even earlier, right? They say,
yes, sure.
In Islamic tradition, there's Al-Ghazali.
Correct.
Correct.
That's so correct.
And I think Aquinas, the West took Arabic writings and then translated them, right?
Definitely. I mean, it's not like Thomas Aquinas. Yeah, you're correct. It's not like Thomas Aquinas was the first one to come up with all these ideas in an original fashion, but he was definitely the one if you want to speak in terms of history of philosophy, he's the one who really, elaborated on it and who got that tradition of cosmological arguments going. So, another cosmological would be the argument for, a first cause that, imagine, the typical children's question of, why does the sun rise in the morning? Well, because, the earth rotates. Well, why does the earth rotate? There's always, whatever we're inquiring of is going to lead us to a cause. But at the end, the more you inquire back in the story of reality, you end up with an infinite regress of causes, which doesn't seem overly reasonable, or you have to start with some fixed, primary, solid, eternal cause. Again, that is just one of those cosmological arguments for a divine creator. And again, it goes back, among others, to Thomas Aquinas.
Yes, exactly. So the cosmological argument, as you just mentioned, is an old argument that has been talked about since the Middle Ages or even earlier, right? So maybe even earlier.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay. Now, if we talk about other philosophical arguments, like the fine-tuning argument, and I've heard also a lot about that argument. Can you maybe walk us through a little bit that argument as well?
Sure. The fine-tuning argument is probably, again, this is not a technically speaking, it's not a cosmological argument in the sense that it is about the beginning of reality or the beginning of the universe, but it has to do with the physical constants of the universe. And the fine-tuning, now the interesting thing about the fine-tuning argument is that it is probably one of the most persuasive arguments, or it seems to be, definitely one of the most persuasive or potentially persuasive arguments for popular atheists. I mean, Christopher Hitchens was or is recorded as saying that the most, the best arguments that theists can dish out is the fine-tuning argument. Richard Dawkins, same thing. He said, if there was an argument that was going to flip him from his disbelief in God to at least openness or belief in God, it would be that, the fine-tuning argument.
Why do you think so? What is the main advantage of that argument versus others?
Yeah, well, let me just I'll explain the argument, or at least summarize it in brief, and then I guess we can get into the question you just asked. So the fine-tuning argument basically describes that there are all those fundamental constants, physical constants in the universe, like, you know, the electromagnetic force, the cosmological the constant of the expansion of the universe, etc., etc. So there are constants in the laws of nature. They're just fixed as, well, you know, they're fixed numbers as mathematics describes them, and they underlie the physical universe. You know, they describe, you know, why we have elements, why stars form, and why they disappear again. All of physical reality is the way it is. Now, if those constants, and there are dozens of them, I mean, there are dozens upon dozens of those fundamental physical constants. If these constants were just changed by a hair's breadth, by, you know, the minuscule percentages, life as we know it, organic life and intelligent conscious life as we know it, would not exist. Like, you know, change any of those constants, and the universe would either be expanding too fast that it would just kind of dissipate, or it would be expanding so slow, too slow, so that it would kind of implode within itself. Or change any of the constants and elements, or carbon couldn't form, etc., etc. Now, again, you combine all these constants, and again, the fact that none of them can be changed even again by the slightest, and you have to ask yourself, well, why is this so? You know, why was the universe, why was physical reality set up this way? And you basically have three potential answers. One is by chance, you know, it just so happened. The second one is by necessity, that is, it is somehow within the laws of nature that they have to be the way they are, that the constants had to come out the way they are. And the third answer is design. Well, somehow these constants were designed or engineered. Now, the second answer, the one of necessity, seems to be like a non-starter, because there doesn't seem to be anything within the universe that requires, you know, for the laws of nature, or for the fundamental constants, to come out the way they were. I mean, these constants, they allowed for the universe to come into existence, or for it to form and turn out the way it has.
Okay.
And so necessity doesn't seem to be an option. Chance, you could say chance, but again, the probability of having a universe that is just perfectly geared and perfectly tuned is so small that chance just isn't a really persuasive option. So the one option we're left with is design.
Okay.
And I guess that's, again, especially scientists or scientists of an atheistic conviction will tell you that, again, that fine-tuning, whether you're a theist or an atheist, fine-tuning is a reality. It's not atheists' invention to say that the universe is fine-tuned. No, the universe is fine-tuned. Those constants are set up in a very intrinsic and delicate manner. And again, if anything was changed by the slightest, you know, life would not exist. So fine-tuning is not something that theists have come up with. It's something that everyone acknowledges. The difference is in how we answer the reason for fine-tuning. And so again, even though atheists, you know, obviously don't allow in their worldview to have a divine being that would function as they explanation for why the universe is fine-tuned. Again, prominent atheists have acknowledged nevertheless that this is a hard one. This is a difficult phenomenon to explain on atheism. Again, design just seems to be a...
Even for them. So yes. Even for atheists, when you mention now the three possibilities, by chance, by necessity, by design, they agree that by design is the most likely hypothesis?
Not necessarily that it's the most likely hypothesis, because, so, I mean, again, and I don't want to put words into Richard Dawkins' mouth, but he has recently on, not too long ago, a year ago, and even in a podcast, again, I heard him speak about, again, a fine-tuning argument. He has said that this is a good one that theists have. I mean, something like this, not at verbatim, but something along these lines. This is a good argument because, I mean, here is the only other solution that atheists have, or that people of a non-theistic conviction have. It is to go with chance. You know, it is by chance that this came up.
Probabilities.
Probability. And then from that, you basically get, or that is one of the reasons why the multiverse hypothesis has been proposed. Because the multiverse hypothesis will say, well, okay, the chances, or the reason why people get to the multiverse hypothesis, or at least one of the reasons, is again the acknowledgement that the chance of getting the universe as we have it, or the chances of getting a life permitting universe as we have it, again, are so small. So let's just suppose that there are millions or billions of other universes, so that at some point, you know, the chance is, you know, it becomes reasonable that one of those universes would turn out as a life-permitting one. It's like, you know, how likely is it that you're gonna, to take a simple example, I mean, if you roll a dice, how likely is it that you're gonna roll a six with one roll? Well, it's one in six, right? And then, so it's not a very very high chance. But if you get if you're given 10 chances to roll a dice, well, you're very likely to roll at least 1-6, you know? Okay. And so in the same way, people will tell you that, well, again, of the life-permitting universe as we know it has a very small chance of existing. But so that's why we're just multiplying the universes, proposing a multitude of universes, that is a multiverse. Thus, it's... Of course, one of those universes must turn out as a life-permitting one.
And it happens that we are in one.
and it happens that we inhabit the one that is the life-permitting one.
Okay.
Now, the problem with that hypothesis is basically that it's the universe that we have is the one that we can access empirically. There is no way to empirically access any other universe than the one we inhabit.
Yep.
And so the multiverse hypothesis basically becomes a leap of faith in something that you cannot empirically get a hold of.
Uh-huh. And so another leap of faith now.
Another leap of faith. Yes. Yeah, another leap of faith. And so then the question really becomes, well, the multiverse may sound like empirical science, or may sound like something that is scientific, but it is, by implication, by definition.
Sorry to cut you. Is it theoretical? Are multiverses still in the theoretical realm, or we have some evidence that there are multiverses?
The problem is that, of course, people who are convinced of the existence of a multiverse will tell you, well, of course, there are theories. But again, it's by definition, we have this universe that we can access. We have no other universe to access. It doesn't seem like we will ever be able to access any other universes, again, supposing that they exist in the first place.
There you go. So it's a theory in itself. So supposing that there are multiverses is in itself an assumption that isn't yet proven.
Fair enough, it's a theory, but even more so, I think the important distinction or definition you want to give here is it is metaphysics. It is not physics. Again, because we're not talking about something that the physical sciences can access. We're talking about something that is beyond that. So just as, so here is the important or the interesting, situation we're left with in the end. It's whether you believe in a creator or in a multiverse. Once you're faced with the fine tuning, you're both taking a leap of faith, or both options involve a leap of faith into the metaphysical. And so at this stage, the atheist cannot accuse the theist of, well, you know, the fine tuning, of course, you just kind of plug in the explanation with the God of the gaps. You just, you know, take this leap of faith. He cannot accuse the theist of doing that without himself or herself acknowledging that he or she is doing the exactly same thing. The belief in a multiverse is a leap of faith into metaphysics. It is not, because again, the scientific method has left us with nothing but access to the universe we have. It's just, it's by definition, we don't have any other universe to describe. And so, of course, the multiverse may sound like physical science, but it is metaphysics. It is a leap into the realm of metaphysics, just as faith in God is.
All right. Okay. I mean, talking about sciences now, I'd like to shift gears a little bit and actually talk about that. Looking at recent scientific discoveries. Okay, let's talk about science. We've talked about philosophical arguments a bit, but if we look at the question from a purely scientific perspective, so discoveries like the Big Bang and advancements in cosmology and quantum mechanics, so you know, all these discoveries, do you think they have impacted arguments for or against the existence of a creator?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, we can pick up the one you mentioned, the Big Bang. I mean, that was like a milestone in the history of science's relation to religion and vice versa. I mean, before, so the Big Bang was discovered, was it the 50s or the 60s? I think in the early 60s. I mean, in the early 60s, the Big...
Was it Lemaître who, I think...
Lemaître, yeah, who was a Catholic priest, was like highly, highly influential and important in the discovery of the Big Bang. He was not the one who formulated the Big Bang as a hypothesis, but he was instrumental and he was a key figure in the history of that. Before the Big Bang theory, I mean, talking about the Big Bang is basically saying that the universe, again, the universe as we know it and as we can access it, had a definite beginning, some 13.8 billion years in the past. And before that, our universe did not exist. Now, before the 60s, before the Big Bang hypothesis was formulated, it was simply believed that the universe was eternal, or that it has always been there, that it was the brute fact of reality. Again, and this plugs right back into what I said at the beginning. Before that, it was believed that our story, the story of reality, just started with the universe, because the universe was that ultimate thing that has always been there. And then in the 60s, it was conclusively discovered that our universe had a beginning 13.8 billion years ago. And so now, if it had a beginning, well, the question obviously arises, what was before the universe and what caused the universe to come into being? And here's where we get to the Kalam cosmological argument. Well, the universe began to exist. And so as anything that begins to exist has a cause, the universe itself must have a cause. Mm. Now, here is another reason why people have come up with the multiverse hypothesis, because whereas fine-tuning will give a motive for the atheist to say, well, there must be multitudes of universes in order that I can meet the heavy requirements of chance and probability, now the beginning of the universe gives the atheist a motive or a motivation to argue for a multiverse, for the multiverse hypothesis, because he or she will say that, well, this universe, yes, it had a beginning, but it is just one of many universes that have come and gone. You know, an eternal succession of universes stretching into the past, each one of them coming into being and dying and then causing the next universe to come into existence.
A succession of expansions and contractions. Yes, and then exactly. The Big Bang is simply the latest expansion. Yeah.
Perfect.
Start of the expansion.
Exactly.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
So,
okay.
There have been many Big Bangs for each of the universes. I mean, each universe had its own Big Bang, and our universe had its Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago as a, I mean, again, very simplistically put, as a reaction or as the effect of the cause of the previous universe ceasing to exist. So here, that's why I said again, when we talked about the fine-tuning of the universe, it is one of the reasons why it has led to the formulation of the multiverse hypothesis. Again, the discovery of our universe having a beginning is another reason why the multiverse hypothesis has been formulated. Now, definitely the Big Bang or the beginning of the universe has given theism, you know, significant support. And I mean, one of the best ways to this manifested is that in the 60s, when the Big Bang was discovered, atheists in the sciences, they reacted strongly against it because they knew that this would give support to theism or to Christianity in particular. Because I mean, the Bible starts at the very beginning saying that in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. So the Bible in its first three words affirms that there was a beginning to reality. And so it was interesting back then in the 60s when the Big Bang was formulated, the editor of, I think it was Nature, which is one of the top three science magazines, the editor of Nature, I can't remember his name, he explicitly expressed his discomfort with the Big Bang theory because, again, explicitly, again, I can't quote him word by word, but he explicitly said, well, I don't like it because it basically gives support to theism. It gives support.
Just because it supports, yes, theism, he doesn't like it?
Well, or at least I did. I don't want to put words into his mouth, but he was...
But I mean, yeah, sorry, but I mean, yeah, I mean, you have to follow the evidence where it leads you, right?
Sure. So, yes, we all would like to think of ourselves as following the evidence wherever it leads, but also, I mean, let's be honest, it's very hard to change your conviction. And I mean, you know, follow the evidence where it leads. People smoke, even though the evidence is right in our face that smoking is not, you know, good for your health, but people will continue to smoke. So it's hard, and this counts for everyone. It's like Christian, atheist, agnostic, whatever.
Sure.
Following the evidence wherever it leads may not be as easy as we'd like to think. And so in this sense, I don't want to kind of, you know, point my finger at the guy, the chief editor of Nature and say, ha, you see, you know, he struggled with that. I just want to make the point that it's not theists who were... The reaction of theists in response to the Big Bang that tells you, well, you know, this is really a discovery that has served the theistic case. But it's reactions from atheists from the other side of the spectrum that make exactly that point. You know, people expressing discomfort with the theory of the Big Bang because they know that gives support to the theistic case.
Do you think, Lucas, in your view, that in general, is there a conflict between science and faith, or do you see them complementary when talking about similar questions than the one that we're talking about today?
Yeah, that's a very good and a very deep question, and lots of ink has been spent on this question. There's different schemes or frameworks which people have come up with to describe the relationship between science and faith. Some people would say, well, they just deal with very different spheres of reality. Science describes the physical world. Faith describes how you ought to behave in the world. you know, whether you should, you know, love your neighbor or, you know, or take revenge or whatever, which has nothing to do with the physical world. And then some people say that, no, there is, you know, for example, there are parallels in methods, in methodological research, both in the realm of religion and science. So we shouldn't just say, well, these two realms have nothing to do with each other. I would look at the issue the following way. If truth, you know, what is true, whether it's a fact of, you know, the fact of science or the fact of the issues of ethics, the issues of aesthetics and beauty, the purpose and meaning, the question of purpose and meaning, I think truth is one. I mean, there is, you know, there's, and I mean, what is true about the world?
Classically speaking, yes, what you're saying is right. But nowadays, looking at the society today, it seems that there are multiple set of truth. There's not one. I mean, I'm not sure if in postmodern times people agree that there's only one truth, right? I mean, people now are very subjective. Every person has their own set of truth, correct? But again, I'm playing the devil's advocate here.
Sure.
But what do you think about that?
Well,
before we go to your question.
Good question. I think, of course, people will tell you that, you know, there are different truths out there. But then, I mean, the response to that stance is simply, well, do you believe that to be true, that there are several truths? So it's to hold that there is not one objective truth, or there isn't objective truth about reality, is a self-undermining stance. And self-undermining statements, they are logically untenable. They can't, you know, they don't make any sense. It's like saying, well, you know, I can't speak a word of English. Well, I just contradicted myself. Thus, what I said isn't true, and it cannot possibly be true by the laws of logic. So in the same way, to say that there is no objective truth is logically self-undermining, because obviously when I make that statement, I believe that to be objectively true. I believe it to be objectively true that there is no objective truth. That doesn't make sense. I'm killing the very statement off that I've just made. And so I understand, of course, these days, everyone wants to uphold that, you know, you have your truth, I have my truth, and let's just, you know, be tolerant and love each other and whatnot. But I think that we're verging into different waters here, but I think that is a very cheap or a very shallow and unfortunate grasp on tolerance. True tolerance is when it happens that we fundamentally disagree on, you know, is there a God? Is there a creator? You know, what is proper ethics and what is the purpose of life? You may have your point of view. I may have my point of view, and yet we can still be friends. You know, I'm committed to respect you and to walk with you. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I have to agree with you in everything. And I think we shouldn't, logically speaking, it is untenable to say that there is no objective truth. Because again,
scientifically speaking as well, usually they seek the truth,
of course,
right? I guess.
Of course. I mean, the whole scientific enterprise is based on the fundamental assumption that there is an objectively identifiable structure to the universe and to the different realms, physics, chemistry, biochemistry, and so on and so forth. I mean, most people, of course, there are postmodern conceptualizations of science that are very different and the kind of that do away or that disregard objective truth. But for most people, I'd say that they believe, I mean, I believe in science, and most people believe in the validity of science because they believe that there are objective laws that underlie the universe, and we can discover them. So,
and you're saying, so, you know, going back to your initial response, you were saying that truth is one and it's common to multiple departments of life, or this is what you want to aim at?
Yeah, we start, because you asked me about the relationship between science and faith. I believe that, you know, there are, again, truth is one, the truth about reality is one whole package. And it, again, it involves truths about science, truths about ethics, truths about aesthetics and about purpose and so on and so forth. And so I do believe that, you know, I believe, for example, that psychology or the social sciences or the neurosciences, they can tell us a great deal about, you know, human well-being. Of course they can. And at the same time, I have, you know, Christ who teaches, you know, that I should love my neighbor as I love myself. And then obviously I can, I love to read psychology and I love to read about communication and I love to read about, you know, human interaction. And I, so these things for me, they plug right in with, you know, my, I guess what I see as one of my fundamental responsibilities to love my neighbor as I love myself. So in this, I would think it to be a shame to say that, well, let's just leave the sciences on one, like leave it for one group of people or for one realm of investigation, and let's have, you know, the religiously inclined dudes do their faith stuff. No, I mean, I'm very interested in some of the scientific disciplines. I'm obviously very interested in philosophy and in questions of ethics. And I, again, I think I see many, many ways in which the two
agree or work together.
At least intersect, yes.
Intersect.
Yeah.
I heard once Bishop Barron, I don't know if you...
Sure, yes. Ever,
yes, you know him. I've heard him once say that faith starts operating at the limit of science. I don't know if you've encountered that.
Yeah.
Yes. So what do you think that means? Like, and how can we, how does it relate to what, to the subject that we're talking about today, science and faith as well?
Yeah, you're onto something there. I mean, if I remember correctly, he said that in, well, where I heard him say that was in his conversation with Alex O'Connor, where he said that faith kicks in at the far end of reason. And what he meant by that, he meant by that, and I very much agree with him, is that faith or the commitment to the divine or to the divine being or to Christ is not a matter of, well, you know, I don't care about rational investigation into, well, into reality. It is not a matter of, well, you know, I don't have to do my homework in terms of figuring out, okay, what is the world? Why does the world look the way it does? Why are human beings the way they are? You know, again, investigating questions of philosophy and science and so on and so forth. That is not faith. He's saying, well, faith is a matter of you do your, to the best of your abilities, you do your homework with reason. But even when you do so, you're going to take a leap of faith into, well, if you want, into the realm of the unknown or into the realm of mystery. And I could give an example here. I mean, I could, you know, if my wife makes a birthday cake for me, I can, like scientists can scientifically analyze that cake. You know, they can completely and utterly just, you know, get on to this cake and give you everything you want in terms of the sciences, chemistry or physics and what have you, and or even quantum physics, you know, at least in principle. But what the sciences can't tell you is why my wife made that cake, you know, unless she will reveal, or unless she will say, well, you know, it's Lucas's birthday and I love him and here's my birthday cake for him. That is such a key aspect.
It's beyond reason. Like,
yes,
it's beyond
reason. It's beyond the sciences. And yet it is actually, I mean, in terms of common sense, it is the most important piece of information about that birthday cake. It's
okay. Like, I see what you mean.
You know, to most of us, when you come home or when you go, I don't know, when you go to your office in the morning and there's a birthday cake somewhere on the, I don't know, in the lunchroom or whatever, none of us is really interested into what this cake is made of in terms of chemistry or what have you. What we're really interested in is, well, you know, why is this cake here? You know, what is this cake doing here? And what's the occasion? Who made it? Again, okay. Which will tell you lots about, again, relationships and about purpose and meaning and what have you. And so...
And these are less kind of prone to scientific, pure scientific inquiry. This is more, we are stepping into the realm of metaphysics here, right? And spirit, maybe spirituality or consciousness. I'm not sure it's...
Yeah, and... Well, ethics and human relationships and matters of trust and love and friendship, which are really the things that matter to people more than questions of, you know, physical makeup of, again, birthday cakes or your bed or your the chair you're sitting on. So I guess to get back to Bishop Barron's statement there, I think you know, at the end of the day, reason can get you very far in discovering and describing and capturing what reality is. But then you still have, reason will not tell you, or will at least be very limited in telling you what the meaning behind the universe is, what the purpose of your life is, and you know, whether life is fundamentally like a good thing or a tragic thing. These are questions that you have to answer in faith. Yeah. And I mean, where you have to latch on to, if you want, where you get into the realm of mystery, again, revelation and all of that stuff, where you're leaving reason. But again, that doesn't mean that that reason doesn't inform your worldview at all. It just means that there are questions in life that are beyond the reach of reason. Like, reason may get you, you know, may lift you up closely to answering those questions, but you have to take a leap of faith and you have to, again, draw on revelation,
But that leap of faith can be informed by reason. Correct.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And that's exactly the reason why Bishop Barron said, you know, faith kicks in at the far end of reason. Again, you lighten up reality as much as you can with the lamp of reason, and yet there are realms to your existence where the light of reason cannot reach. And this is where you're going to take a leap into mystery, yeah.
Into mystery. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about what the philosopher Alvin Plantinga says. And I think this is very relevant to our discussion today. He said that believing in a creator is a properly basic belief. And then, you know, the person who holds that belief is perfectly justified. So in a way, he's acting rationally. I don't know if you are familiar with that particular... Yes. Can you explain a little bit, what does he exactly mean here?
Yeah. Unless I'm mistaken, the word basic belief, I mean, it's not something that Plantinga came up with. That's a term from epistemology. And it basically means that it's a belief that does not depend on other beliefs. It's a basic belief, like a brute... Plantinga is suggesting or proposing that we consider belief in God to be like that. It's another typical basic belief would be, you know, the belief in the laws of logic. You assume them.
Yeah, you don't question. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Them. Well, they don't. It's a belief that does not depend on something, on another belief. You know, if I. I believe that Washington, D.C. is the capital of the U.S. Well, that may not be described as a base, that may not be held to be a basic belief, because I have I also have to believe that the United States of America exists. I have to believe that there is history to how the country came into being, and so on and so forth. So a basic belief is a belief that does not depend on other beliefs. And so what Plantinga is saying is that belief in God can rationally, or again, he submits this as his proposal or as a proposition, that belief in God is properly basic. You're justified in holding that belief without having to inquire further why a God exists. And I mean, this is what, like another angle to look at this, which people may be more familiar with, is when people say that this is a very different take on the same issue here, but people may be more familiar with that one. It's to say that belief in God is something that is innate in us. It's something
innate,
that
yes exactly.
It's kids will grow up and grasp very easily the concept of a divine being, you know?
Okay.
And I mean studies have been done about this, books have been written about, again, the naturalness of belief in God. It's not kids, for example.
It's not a societal conditioning. It's
no.
They're not conditioned by society.
No. Well, believe. You can still hold that it is conditioned, but it is something that we have very, like, an easy time wrapping our heads around, at least as kids, you know, believe in God. That's not at all what Plantinga is saying, but it is a similar take on belief in God by saying, well, you're justified in holding that belief. It's just, you know, that is a brute aspect or a brute aspect of reality, or you can consider the brute aspect of reality that there is a divine creator. Of course, other people would say that, well, you should take it as a brute aspect of reality that there is no divine creator. Just, you know, it is a properly basic belief that there is no God. Now, obviously,
we will talk about a couple of objections like after that, because I have a few in mind that I want to also discuss with you and take your opinion on that. But maybe you wanted to finish on that piece first.
Yeah, I'm just saying that Plantinga is suggesting here that belief in God is basic. It does not require justification by some other proposition. You're justified in believing in God because belief in God is, again, that's what it means to say that it is properly basic.
Okay. Doesn't require further, like, explanation.
No.
In a way. Yes,
exactly.
I see.
It's okay. just as beliefs in the laws of logic, if you hold them, you take them as, again, a brute aspect of reality. Well, no one would think you're out of your mind. That's fully rational to hold.
So in a way, he's saying most people, or like many people, feel like believing in God is natural, is normal, is something that they feel without even having to go through arguments. Right.
Yes.
That's what he's saying.
He's saying, yes, you are not required to explain your belief in God by reference to other beliefs you hold. By other propositions you hold. If you believe in God, well, that's good enough because it's a basic belief. You know, you don't need to give further explanation for your belief. Your belief is basic. You go with it.
Okay. Now I'd like to talk a bit about a few common objections.
Sure.
From skeptics. So there are lots, but let's quickly explore just a couple. So the first one, the hiddenness of God. So skeptics, they claim that there's no observable or empirical evidence or palpable evidence for the existence of a creator. But they also say if such a creator truly exists, if a loving and all-powerful creator exists, why is he hiding from us, and why can't we see him? Why doesn't he see us? You see what I mean? So this is kind of one of the main arguments that we keep on hearing. What is your take on that?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's one I take very seriously. I mean, in general, I mean, yes, I want to take it seriously. And I know that in many cases, the question is asked from a very personal angle rather than just a philosophical, you know, ploy, so to speak. It's also the question that I discussed with Cosmic Skeptic over in a podcast with Unbelievable. I very much enjoyed that. Now,
it was a very good, I saw that video. It was a very good discussion between both of you.
Yeah, thank you. We had a great time even afterwards. It was a really good conversation. So, there are several kind of takes on a response here. One of them is, well, again, well, look at the fine tuning. Look at the very people who bring up the question of, well, why hasn't God made himself more manifest? I would first respond by saying, well, I mean, have you looked at the evidence? Have you studied the arguments again for the existence of God? You know, what are the things that you find persuasive or at least fairly persuasive? What are the things that you don't think are persuasive? For example, I mean, in my conversation with Alex O'Connor, I told him, as I looked, I mean, in preparation for that conversation, I remembered him talking about the ontological argument for God's existence, which we don't have to get into that now. Years ago, he was, you know, making fun of it, saying that this was such a ridiculous argument for God. It can't even be taken seriously in any manner. Years later, he came back and said that this is a genius. Like this is even magical. He used the word magic. He said this is a magical argument for God. He says this is a great argument for God.
Although I think it's one of the least. I mean, it's a difficult argument to understand. Not everybody can understand. Yeah. And it's small. Let's not get into it anyway.
No, but not get into it. I mean, I would never use that argument to in a discussion with someone who wants to debate the existence of God, because it's so weird and complex. And yet, this doesn't matter. All I said to Alex, well, Alex, you yourself thought that this was ridiculous. And then you came back, and again, he did use the word, it's magical. It's a magical argument. And so I told him, well, Alex, wouldn't you have to acknowledge or admit that at least when we look at this argument for the existence of God, that somehow God has come out of the hiding? You know, if that doesn't, I mean, obviously he has not turned out to be a theist, but at least it seems to me that when it comes to this one consideration of theism through the ontological argument, like he made a 180 degree U-turn. Mm. And so I told him, well, you know, it seems to me that somehow God has actually come out of the hiding for you, at least as far as this argument is concerned. And so all I want to say here is, in response to the skeptic who brings up the hiddenness argument, is, which again, I take it seriously. But I also would want to face the skeptic with the question and ask, well, again, have you seriously and to the best of your abilities engaged with the rich tradition of, again, theistic arguments and Christian philosophy? You know, and what are the areas where you feel like, well, you know, this is legit. This really doesn't make sense. Because, again, even a person like Richard Dawkins will tell you that, well, you know, fine tuning is a fairly good piece of argument in the hands of theists. And then starting from there to also venture into the areas, and maybe more the personal and psychological areas in a person's life who says that, well, you know, I can't believe in God. Because as we said before, we would all like to think that we follow the evidence wherever it leads. And yet people smoke, people will not, you know, have the humility to reconcile to others, even when they know that they are part of a personal dispute or problem. And so I would also gently, and I mean, at the appropriate time and when the setting or kind of the relationship is right, ask a skeptic, well, may there be issues other than pure evidence that keep you from, believing in God? Are you worried about the implications, like the moral demands that on your life that are implied in a commitment to God, you know?
Yes, I see. Okay, so this is for the hiddenness of God, which is one big piece. But the second one that they keep on bringing, and I'm sure you guessed it, is the problem of evil, right?
Sure.
And I know we're not going to go into that rabbit hole now. It maybe warrants a full episode on that. But very quickly, because this is a very popular objection as well. You know, if actually we are here and universe exists because there is a loving creator, then why do we have suffering? Why do we have evil? Why isn't this all goodness, which is God? How can it be that it didn't vanquish this evil?
Yeah, very, very good question. First of all, like a key distinction that needs to be made is the difference between natural evil and moral evil. The question of, well, why are there tornadoes and earthquakes that make people suffer? It requires a very different answer from the question of, well, why do people engage in war and, you know, all types of other evils, you know, against each other? And so the only thing I want to say is that the theist is not required to give a one-fits-all type of answer. I think there is an answer to the question of natural evil, and there's an answer to the question of moral evil. And I'm going to focus on the latter for our purpose here. I mean, what's been called the free will defense is really, I think, the best answer to that question. And my take on it, or my version of it, is the following. I think most of us would agree that there are two values which we seem to cherish over more than anything else. And I think it's the value of autonomy. I can decide over my own destiny and how I want to lead my life. I'm the master of my own destiny. And, you know, the value of love. Listen to any song, watch any movie, and you will find that, you know, these are the two things that all of culture, or most of culture, seems to talk about. You know, it's all sci-fi movies is, well, how can humanity retain its autonomy and freedom against some outside evil force? And most movies in general are about the question of, well, how can I attain true love? How can I want to love and to be truly loved? And the fact of the matter is that these two issues, autonomy and love, true love, they're actually linked in the following sense, that you cannot have true love if you're not truly autonomous. If we were determined, if God made us robots that would just follow his commands the way he wanted them, then, well, he could guarantee that there is no evil, that people would always do good or would always do what is right. But true love would be out of the picture, because if you're just programmed to do good to someone, it's impossible for you to truly love them. It's true love has to be chosen.
It has to be a free choice.
It has to be a free choice. And so I believe that, and again, this is essentially the answer of the free will defense in response to the question of why is there evil. I believe that God set up the world in a way that he gave human agents the privilege of free choice. We can choose what we want to do with our lives. Now, with the fact of free will come the acts of free will. Given that I have free will, I obviously get to choose whether I would want to use my free will for the good of those around me or for the bad. And if I choose the former, well, you know, kindness and compassion and mercy and love will ensue. And if I choose the latter, well, that's where hence you end up with the problem of evil. But it's now, here's obviously people could say, well, why didn't God create us as robots? At least he, like, is free will really worth it? You know, was it really worth it for God to give us free will so that we can have, again, you know, true love and kindness? Wouldn't it have been better for him to just create us as machines or programmed agents who do what he does. Well, and to at least we wouldn't have to deal with all this evil all around us. Well, and to that I would answer, well, would you really want to live in that universe? Again, I look into, I look at movies and I listen to music, and it seems like humanity or the culture seems to be shouting, yes, we want to be free and we want to be truly loved and to love. And so I think that all of us agree that a life or an existence that is undergirded or defined even by free will and the possibility of true love is far more valuable than a life that is controlled, be it by some alien or outside force or a god. And so
I see. So
my answer to the question of evil would be that, well, I think God took that route because it seems a world where true kindness and true love exist, yes, with the risk and with the fact of true evil and true hatred still seems to be more valuable than a world in which, again, free will, neither free will nor true love exist.
Okay. I mean, the topic and the whole discussion was fascinating and very, very interesting as well. And I think it requires more than just an hour episode or session together. But what I wanted to talk a little bit about is you, Lucas, and your work now. So I know you run a YouTube channel called Deflate. Can you tell us a bit more about this channel and what you do?
Yeah, sure, Imad. Well, it's interesting you're asking me this question now and at this point, because I'm rethinking how I want to move forward with my YouTube channel. Basically, I started 4 years ago. I was very much geared towards responding to common arguments against Christian theism. I engaged with all sorts of atheist YouTubers. I mean, chiefly among them, Cosmic Skeptic, because I thought he was just, and I still
which
think
is Alex O'Connor.
Yeah, sorry.
Now he's known
yeah,
by
sorry.
That name.
Yeah, right. Sorry. Back then he still ran by the name of Cosmic Skeptic, because I thought that he was just the most nuanced and most engaging and most interesting conversation for him. I did have, I mean, conversations and responses with Rationality Rules, Genetically Modified Skeptic. I was on Goddess Engineers channel and so on and so forth. So a lot of my channel was set up, or most of my videos were set up in response to
atheists.
To atheists or skeptics, yes.
Okay.
And then, well, we launched an event cafe here in Beirut 2 years ago, where, for example, discussions like the ones that we're having right now would happen in a community setting. And when we launched 2 years ago, exactly 2 years ago, in fact, I didn't have the capacity to keep up with my YouTube work. So I put the whole thing on hold for almost 18 months.
Okay.
And then I came back in spring this year, around April. And since then, I've actually been wondering, again, have been doing some soul searching, well, how I want to move forward with my YouTube channel. I've kept doing like responses and more short format videos, but now, yeah, I'm actually trying to find my sweet spot again in whether I should just keep engaging with those, again, philosophical questions or objections towards Christianity, or whether I should do something else. I'm creating a bunch of videos where I speak about, you know, supposed contradictions or inconsistencies in the biblical narrative. So I'm trying this one out. And then, maybe as a disappointment to the question you asked, but at the moment I'm a bit in limbo or a bit in transition.
Still, yeah, you haven't decided which direction to go.
Exactly. Okay. Where I should take this, yeah.
Well, whatever direction you choose, Lucas, I wish you the best of luck in your,
thank you,
in your
man.
Future endeavors.
Thank
Any
you,
final
man.
Words?
Well, I mean, I hope that your viewers found this interesting And I mean, feel free to check out what I have on my channel. Again, please bear with me. Bear in mind that I've been, again, working through a bunch of questions how to move forward with my channel. But yeah, I love this. And I hope this was beneficial to people who are, you know, venturing into questions of, well, is there a creator? And if there is one, how am I supposed to respond? And all of that, yeah.
No, it was very informative. And I think personally, the topic is fascinating. And I'm sure, our audience will find big value in our discussion today.
So thank you
very much again, Lucas.
Thank you.
And yeah, best of luck.
Thank you. Same to you. All right.
Bye.
Bye, man.
Bye.